Our first case for argument this morning is Indiana Protection and Advocacy Services against Indiana Family and Social Services Administration. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Chief Judge Easterbrook, and may it please the Court. IPAS, a state agency, has sued other state agencies in federal court regarding two state hospital patients. Now, with regard to both patients and the records that were requested, there are overarching threshold issues relating to sovereign immunity and whether IPAS has a cause of action. With respect to patient one, there is also a substantive merits issue, if you will, relating to whether peer review documents must be disclosed under the Disability Discrimination Act and under PAMI. With regard to patient two, there is no merits-related issue. The state has turned over what it has been able to identify in terms of the documents that IPAS has requested. However, IPAS has identified one document that the state has been unable to locate, but those efforts are continuing. So I think to their satisfaction, that case is not quite resolved as far as the documents go. As to the threshold issues with respect to sovereign immunity, first of all, I think that it probably bears talking about the waiver issue, since the sovereign immunity issue was not raised until the panel raised it while it was on appeal in the first go-around. Our view is that...
Well, why didn't you raise it?
I think it was just an oversight, Your Honor. I don't think there's anything strategic, intentional, just an oversight.
You can't take it very seriously and make an oversight. You don't mind litigating on the merits.
Well, I think
if you make oversights like that, it's just you don't take it very seriously.
I think the state of Indiana takes it seriously.
Well, then why? Then you think they would notice when they were being sued?
Well, I think in all fairness, this issue of what this particular animal of agency suing another state agency hadn't arisen before. It just wasn't on the
radar. What difference does that make to the suit against the government?
What difference does it make? Well, it simply is not the
Why would that affect the 11th Amendment?
Well, I don't think it does.
Didn't you know, if you think the 11th Amendment is important in Indiana, why is it that have you taken steps against the lawyer who committed this oversight for giving away the sovereignty of Indiana?
No, we haven't gone that far, Your Honor.
No, because you don't really care.
No, we do. We care very much about our sovereign immunity. And we care very much when state agencies try to sue other state agencies in federal court.
But, Mr. Fisher, let me push this a little further. Of course, IPAS is charged with representing developmentally disabled and mentally ill people. And so its capacity is really as almost a guardian for these individual people. And so, yes, you can call it a state agency, but the hat that it's wearing, at least in this case, doesn't look very much like the state, which is one reason I think maybe you may have overlooked this aspect of things. And, of course, another aspect that concerns me is this is very much like other areas where this court has seen where the state had a choice of how to go about accepting these federal funds. It could have created a private entity, as 42 states have done, or it could have created a state agency. So in that sense, it reminds me very much of the Telecommunications Act structures, where the state makes a choice, but in making that choice, the state recognizes that lawsuits may be brought by this entity, and they may be brought sometimes against state entities.
Well, I think with respect to the latter point, Your Honor, this is not like the telecommunications scenario in the sense that the state has not bought into a federal scheme of regulation where the state agency that is, I think, the collateral consequence of accepting aid is a regulator. Or in the telecommunications context, typically what you see is a telecommunications company suing a state agency, the state agency having assumed the federal responsibility for regulation. This is
right,
not
but the analogy, for example, in our MCI case was precisely to this kind of situation where federal funds are given to the state. The state didn't have to take these federal funds, and if it wanted to keep its sovereign immunity pure, it could have simply created a private entity, as many states did.
Well,
nothing requires the state of Indiana to give up a thing.
On the other hand, nothing put the state of Indiana on notice that by accepting federal funds, it would be waiving sovereign immunity.
Sure it did. These analogies, I mean, I guess it depends. That's almost a circular argument. If the state of Indiana takes money under a statute that says the Indiana Protective Advocacy Service is going to have the power to bring lawsuits and it's going to have the power to, in other ways, enforce the law, I don't know why the state of Indiana didn't think it could do that.
I don't think that that's sufficiently specific. There is no overt statement in PAYME or in the DD Act saying that a state waives its sovereign immunity against suits in federal court with regard to
Would you concede that the language of the two acts is not so different? Permission for the state to bring a civil action on behalf of residents in the Telephone Act sounds very much like the authority to pursue legal remedies to ensure the protection of individuals in the PAYME Act. I mean, why is this so different?
Well, in part because in the telecom area, you're always talking about a state regulator. You're not always talking about a state defendant in this scenario. You don't have necessarily only state hospitals or state clinics or whatever that would be defendants. There's nothing in there to say, as a state, you must especially be on guard for these kinds of lawsuits. And the Supreme Court has made it clear that if Congress is going to condition receipt of federal funds on a waiver of sovereign immunity, that has to be made crystal clear in the Act.
But doesn't it bother you that your argument leads to this really strange result that IPAS can sue private hospitals and healthcare providers to enforce, but not state providers, or that PNA's private sister agencies in other states can sue to enforce the act, but IPAS can't?
Well, setting aside the cause of action issue, I think for purposes of your question, Indiana perhaps made its choice when it sought to do this. Maybe the decision was, if there are going to be any suits, we want to create this as a state entity. That was an option that Congress left to the states to make.
So a state can take federal money and then unilaterally determine whether it will be amenable to suit by designating a public versus private system. So, therefore, the effectiveness of the act would vary from state to state depending on whether it was public or private. Does that make any sense?
It was Congress's decision to set it up that way. Congress gave the states the option to do that and did not say that the funds would be conditioned on waiver of sovereign immunity.
But you're sticking to these words. I think when we pass a statute that says that this entity has the right to bring lawsuits and there's even an exhaustion requirement prior to instituting any legal action. Do you think Congress was just kidding when it put those words in? It seems completely unlikely to me that Congress would have created this gaping hole that you seem to think exists.
Well, kidding, no, but I think that could anticipate equally suits in state court or could anticipate suits against other types of entities. Congress was being very general there, and what they were not doing was being specific in their insistence that states waive immunity by accepting funds, and that's exactly
what... It's comical in light of your insouciance toward sovereign immunity. Let me ask you this. It's one thing if in the district court you forgot about sovereign immunity, 11th Amendment, you know, and then you come up to the Court of Appeals and say, oh, very sorry, you know, we slipped, but we'd like to be relieved from our forfeiture. But not even to raise it at the appellate level. That, I would think, would be an explicit waiver.
Well,
I mean, we're not in the business of thinking up arguments, unless it's jurisdictional in the strict sense, you know, not allowed to have a suit at all, unwaivable jurisdictional problem. We're not in the business of making up grounds after the oral argument and saying, yeah, well, you should have thought of it. And we think it. Why would the 11th Amendment want to protect states against suits when the states don't care enough to establish some procedures by which they can protect themselves in court, like a law which said the Attorney General couldn't waive the 11th Amendment? That would be effective. That would
I'm
be
not sure
fine.
It would, candidly, in light of Lapidus. I mean, I think Lapidus was repudiating Ford to the extent that...
Well, but that certainly is... This is certainly an a fortiori case for waiver compared to a situation which the state has said, we care so much about the 11th Amendment, we're actually going to have a law saying the Attorney General can't waive it in court.
Well, we have a law in Indiana that says that we reserve our right to sovereign immunity. It doesn't go as far as what you're saying.
Yeah, right. It doesn't. I mean, so if you don't care enough to establish procedures by which your lawyers think to assert the 11th Amendment, what's the federal interest? What's the federal interest in protecting state sovereign immunity? That's a state interest.
Why is it a federal interest? It's a structural interest that the court has
recognized. Why is it structure? I don't understand. If the states don't care, why should the federal government care?
Well, the states do care, and it's a matter of what the Constitution.
But the states are permitted to waive their sovereign immunity, right? They're permitted to do that. That suggests there's not a federal interest in preserving sovereign immunity. It's a state interest. The state doesn't assert it. What's the federal interest in asserting it on the state's behalf?
Well, the Supreme Court has made it clear that that is...
That's not an answer. That's an appeal to authority. Is there a reason?
Yes, I think that the federal government, whether it's in the judiciary or otherwise, has a vested interest in preserving the divided and limited government.
Because there's nothing to prevent a state from waiving its 11th Amendment rights, right? If the federal government gives you another $100 million, you'll waive your sovereign immunity, right?
Yes, but the point remains that where states have not intentionally availed themselves of the federal forum, they retain the ability to assert sovereign immunity for the first time on appeal. And this court, it has certainly the authority to raise it sua sponte, which is what happened before the original panel.
So what I want to know, Mr. Fisher, is whether the logical result of your argument is to say that Indiana has been out of compliance with the conditions under the PIMI Act ever since you've been taking money, and that, in fact, you owe all of that money back to the government, because you have not, in fact, created a P&A system that's able to pursue administrative, legal, and other appropriate remedies under your view, and you have not, in that sense, complied with the conditions of the law.
Well, I think we've complied because
we... But no, you haven't. You don't have any system that can pursue administrative, legal, and other appropriate remedies.
I don't know why. I mean, IPAS can do that.
No, they can't. Not you. There are a lot of state hospitals. They most certainly cannot.
But they can sue others in another course.
To sue somebody who's not involved, that's an unbelievable position.
But the legislative history of this statute shows that Congress was concerned overwhelmingly with state hospitals. Would you agree with that?
I think that that's probably right.
And that's what the Senate staff report addressed. We have to deal here with the possibility of private caregivers against which enforcement might be directed. But state hospitals are really the key, and the statute requires independence of the authority that governs those state hospitals, correct?
Correct.
And the governor can't appoint more than one-third of the members of the board?
I think that's right.
So this is not a situation where he can give an order to IPAS saying stop this lawsuit the way you could if, for example, the Environmental Management Agency sued the Highway Department.
No, but of course the governor can't stop lawsuits from any number of other agencies in state government either.
He can order those folks who serve at his pleasure to drop their lawsuits, right?
True, but there's a lot more to the state of Indiana than the agencies that serve under the governor. The governor could not order the Attorney General to drop a lawsuit or to prosecute a lawsuit. So I think that the notion that there's an independence there, it ultimately just goes too far to differentiate IPAS from other state agencies, which also have independence. It's part of the nature of Indiana government to have many independent agencies. Now, to the extent that there is some suggestion that we haven't been in compliance with this act because maybe there are a few areas where there could have been a lawsuit but there wasn't, the federal government...
Major gaping areas, as Judge Hamilton says, every case involving a state provider of medical services. You would agree with that? Yeah. Not a single case where the hospital or healthcare system is state-owned is within the authority of the P&A system to sue.
No, I don't agree with that. I think the P&A system could sue, if it had a cause of action, could sue.
Well, now you're switching grounds. We can talk about cause of action, but you were saying that the 11th Amendment itself prevents the P&A system, IPAS here, from suing anybody in the state. And I'm saying, so that means you've been out of compliance with the statute if you're correct about that. Now, if you want to move to the cause of action argument, we can.
I would like to correct a misimpression. I'm not saying that they can't sue the state anywhere. They can't sue us in federal court. They could sue us in state court.
I'm not sure. Under Alden against Maine?
There's no abrogation issue. It's the fact that the state of Indiana Supreme Court does not often recognize immunity in the state court suits against the state. We have cited cases, in fact, under the action for mandate that are cases brought against state agencies in state court.
For a federal cause of action?
No, I don't have that on a federal cause of action.
That's what I'm concerned about. Well, since the PIMI Act, the last I checked, was passed by Congress, not the Indiana legislature.
What I'm saying is we don't have authority that affirmatively says IPASS cannot sue the state of Indiana in state court. Our argument today is limited to suits in federal court.
Yeah, because, of course, it's a big problem if they sue in state court because the remedies will vary from state to state. So, like in Virginia, it would take an action of mandamus in their Supreme Court to get access to the records, which is an extraordinary remedy. So you don't think that's what Congress intended, do you?
Congress intended a broad arrangement for setting up these agencies that could sue and be sued, and that's what we have here. But it didn't say anything about waiving sovereign immunity in federal court.
I don't see why this isn't a little bit like the Keytronic case, where actually Congress, moving a little bit to the cause of action, does have a lot of language in this statute that authorizes the system to pursue administrative, legal, and other appropriate remedies. It talks about prior to instituting any legal action in a federal or state court on behalf of an individual. There's language throughout this statute, express language, that we would have to set aside if you are correct.
Well, I don't think that would be required to set aside.
Oh, sure we would. If it's a state agency, as you insist on calling the IPASS.
Well, I guess I'm not following the question, but it seems the
you don't think a state agency can ever sue a state provider of services. And I'm saying if you're right, if there's no cause of action for the state agency when it's structured as a state agency as opposed to a private entity, then there's a lot of language in this statute that's just so much verbiage.
Well, again, we're not saying that there can never be a lawsuit by IPASS against a state agency. It just can't be in federal court. Now, as to cause of action,
what is the situation if IPASS were to sue a state hospital in state?
Well, we would still make the response that there's no cause of action under these acts. It is quite conceivable that there would be a cause of action.
I'm bothered by conceivable because unless you're willing to show us that there's a state remedy, then you have very serious. With an unenforceable.
I haven't seen a case. That's why I can't be 100%.
Well, what about the law? Isn't there a law?
Yes.
Well, can state agencies can a state agency sue under some state law to get these to get these copies?
We have cases showing that state agencies as defendants are not immune from actions for mandate. Actions for mandate are situations where the court can order an agency or an agency official to comply with a strict duty. So
are you telling us there's an adequate state remedy which would be the equivalent of the federal remedy and would give the IPASS, right to get copies of these documents?
I'm saying that there is a plausible.
Yes or no?
I don't have a 100% answer for you. I don't know.
How about 95% answer? You have a 10% answer, 1% answer, or what?
I would say certainly greater than 50%. It looks like a cause of action that could fly. I don't know if there's something.
That's a very satisfactory answer because I would think that would have been your key research in preparing this appeal to assure us that the statute is not completely empty. If there's no federal remedy.
Look, all I'm saying is there isn't a court that has enforced this.
Look, you can have a legal judgment without a case.
But the Supreme Court of Indiana is not bound by my legal judgment. I think it would fly.
No,
I don't know what
but
they
you
would
could
say.
Say to us, you've done research, you've looked at this state and that state and Indiana procedure and this and that, and you can assure us with some high probability that IPASS would have perfectly good state remedy and there's no need to get into this 11th Amendment. You could do that. You haven't done that.
Well, I'm not sure what more I can say.
There is something perfectly straightforward you can say. You can say that you, on behalf of the state of Indiana, hereby consent to suit in state court.
I don't, well, I don't think that's necessary. The court has already said it's not a consent issue. It's not a consent. I guess what I'm saying is it's not a consent issue.
If the concern, your concern in response to this question, had to do with a potential immunity in state court against suits based on federal law, even though the state is amenable to suit based on state court, on state law. That's the Alden possibility. And just as a state can consent, that is, waive its immunity to be sued in federal court, it can waive any immunity to be sued in state court. So the question being asked of you is, will you make, on the record, a formal consent to be sued in state court, not to assert any immunity?
I don't think I can do that knowingly and voluntarily because I don't know what the degree of immunity would be.
General Fisher, if in state court we have this suit that's been discussed, that is IPAS versus another agency, who does the Attorney General represent?
The Attorney General would represent the agency.
Well, so...
I mean, not IPAS.
Not IPAS. Right. You wouldn't have a special Attorney General situation?
No, IPAS is authorized to hire its own outside lawyers. There's no issue of its litigation being controlled by the Attorney General.
There's a problem with the state state statute doesn't...
The enabling state statute only says that IPAS can sue and be sued. I think our view is that the a cause of action for mandate would generally be available to IPAS.
There is no mandate in the...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. I think that's more of a merits-oriented, but yes, I see what you're driving at.
The point is that Indiana state statutory scheme all of the rights that it's...
That's true. I will say, I think, though, that to the degree that we have accepted the funds, there is a degree of self-execution here. I think that we would be in breach of the grant agreement if we were not to afford the detailed list of requirements that are set forth in the DDA Act and the Pay Me Statute.
So it's,
that it doesn't necessarily require an enabling act that goes through each of those detailed provisions.
In that case, then, would you be asking the state court to apply federal law or state law?
I think it would be federal law.
And you don't think that's a problem?
I don't. I for what reason? I mean, I think on the sovereign immunity, I doubt it. I don't know for sure. We don't have a case on the cause of action. It seems like a colorable cause of action, but I don't know for sure how it would go.
Mr. Fisher, can I ask you a little bit? We've been talking a lot about the 11th Amendment. The briefs talk about Ex parte Young as a fairly straightforward solution to that problem. And we do have state officials named in their official capacity as defendants in this case. In your brief on rehearing, you rely on the sunken ship salvage cases to try to argue that Ex parte Young won't reach that. As I understand it, the plaintiffs don't actually want to take the records away from you the way that some folks might want to take gold bars away from sunken galleons. But they simply want to inspect and copy. Is that right?
That's right.
So does that suggest a reason for distinguishing those cases?
Not in my view, because I think part of the property right that we're asserting there is the right of exclusiveness. That is one of
the right of what, I'm sorry?
Exclusiveness, to exclude others from using the property at stake.
Well, why? They're going to sell the copies and impair?
No.
This is a copyright argument?
It doesn't matter. It's just that these are the state's documents.
So you're treating it as an intellectual property case?
I think it's a property case. It's whether it's intellectual or physical or whatever, it's our property.
No, they're not taking your physical property. So what? They're just making a copy. So what is it that they're taking from you?
The information.
Information. So that's valuable. You spent money obtaining this information, and now they're appropriating the information. It's like a theft of a trade secret, or
no, it's a breach of confidences.
I don't understand why these are exclusively the state's records. Anyway, they pertain to the patient. The patient, I would presume, has HIPAA rights in them. It seems to me they're joint, and then takes you right back to the purpose of the federal statute, the PIME Act and the DD Act, which says that this agency, this particular agency, under strict confidentiality rules itself, by the way, also has the right to look at them. It's similar, although not exactly the same, as a case we had a little while back about whether a university had a property right in a transcript, and it was concluded there not enough to withhold that transcript from the person who was willing to pay for it, the student. The joint interest situation.
What we're suggesting is that even so, the degree of interest that the state has is enough to make this an inappropriate remedy under ex parte.
To preclude the viewing of the record on the part of somebody with a federal statutory right to advocate for the patient.
It's a matter of ex parte Young and the relief that it permits.
But it's not at all like Coeur d'Alene. It's I mean, after Verizon, I think the idea that Coeur d'Alene repealed ex parte Young was put to rest.
No, I think that what's going on with Coeur d'Alene is that you have to take account of the general sovereign interest, the interest in being the sovereign. Not
and that was argued in Verizon, and Coeur d'Alene was understood to be a case that dealt with this very special problem of the land. That your case looks much more like Verizon.
Well, I don't think that Verizon repudiates what Coeur d'Alene says about taking account of the special sovereign interest. That remains.
I don't know. Okay, well, that's fine.
Mr. Fisher, can I ask you a question about cause of action since our time is running here? Let's suppose that Indiana's Family and Social Service Administration simply stopped complying. They said, we aren't going to comply with these statutes. We're not going to share any information with the Protection and Advocacy Service. If there's no cause of action, if you're right, is there any remedy available?
The federal government can cut off the grants.
Is there an administrative process that's been set up to do that?
My reading of the statute is that the federal government undertakes audits, et cetera, and makes a conclusion that a state is not in compliance. Then there is an ability for a state to contest that through judicial.
But there's nothing like, for example, the system that was set up in Gonzaga University under Title IX.
There's no elaborate scheme that I'm
okay.
Cutting off the grants, I mean, that's an obvious cutting off its nose despite its face situation. Surely it's counter IPAS's goal of helping people in the state with abilities.
I don't think we focus on IPAS for that. I think that we focus on the state of Indiana. The legislature of Indiana has made it clear that for the people of the state of Indiana, they want to have this system. But if we don't comply with what Congress has said, we can't do it.
This audit situation, how long does this take?
I don't know.
Right. And so in terms of the patient could be years waiting for the money to be taken away. In addition to the point that Judge Rovner has made, the audit has no there's no real process set up.
It's the process that Congress has left us with.
How much money has Indiana received?
I don't know offhand.
Mr. Fisher, before you sit down, what do you think? Provision.
Can speak up.
Sorry. I'm asking about the import of the language in the exhaustion provision of the statute that refers specifically to legal action in federal or state court. Mm-hmm. How are we to read that?
It's a general exhaustion requirement. It doesn't anticipate any particular defendant. There may be actions in federal court against other defendants. There may be causes of action that implicate exhaustion requirements that need to be taken account of. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Galanter.
May it please the court, Seth Galanter for IPAS. This is a suit to enforce federal law against state officials who are relying on state law and custom to deny IPAS copies of records they're entitled to. It's appropriately brought under Ex parte Young, and for that reason alone, the 11th Amendment does not bar the suit.
So you concede that you need to drop the state agency itself as a defendant?
With the exception of the fact that they never raised that issue until the en banc briefing. If they had raised it in the district court, yes, it should have been dismissed. And we didn't need them because we brought the suit against the relevant state officials in their official capacity. Of course, this court has suggested in Crescetto, and the other courts have suggested after Lapidus, that when a state actively participates in the litigation on the merits, and here remember there were cross motions for summary judgment after a stipulation of facts, that in those kinds of circumstances, the state can't say after it loses, oh wait, we forgot, we have immunity from this suit. But putting aside the agency itself, the suit can go forward and all the relief we need can be obtained against the state officials. And there we're in core ex parte Young area. We have a claim that they're violating federal law. It's brought against the state officials, and we are seeking prospective relief. We're not seeking damages. And just to clarify, they suggest at one point that the violation's in the past and all we want to do is fix something in the past. But here, just like in the when someone's fired from their job, you can use Ex parte Young to get reinstatement if that firing was wrongful or an expulsion from school, the same thing. Here we're seeking to cure the violation by getting the records that we were entitled to in the first place, just as the person is entitled to get their job back with the, you know, benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And we are not in this property interest, as was pointed out by the panel, or pointed out in the questioning before. We are here seeking inspection and copying of records. We're not seeking to possess them or to take title to them. And this is exactly the kind of right that every civil plaintiff gets in discovery. So if they're claiming that they don't have to provide these documents to us, what they're really saying is they're immune from civil discovery, immune from subpoenas. And that's never been the rule. And in fact, when a state raised it, this court rejected it.
Isn't there some right to confidentiality in this?
There is. And under the federal statute, the IPAS is governed by that confidentiality, federal and state confidentiality rules, except to the extent that the PAMI Act specifically exempts it, which is a narrow exemption, which probably won't even come into play here because, regrettably, patient one, for whom we are seeking the peer review records, died while in state custody. And the whole point here is where IPAS is trying to figure out what happened and did the state do enough to investigate what happened.
And hypothetically, should you want to disseminate these records, let's assume you got the records for inspection, you copied them, and you wanted to disseminate, how would you go about that dissemination? Would you have to get the approval of a court, and wouldn't the state have a right to come in and object if you wanted to do that?
Normally, let me say first that we don't, IPAS does not disseminate these records, right. And there are federal regulations it keeps. They keep them in a separate room and locked cabinets, and they maintain them just as state and federal law require. I do not believe that if disclosure, and this is on page 4A of the statutory appendix in the red brief, disclosure, it says we can disclose the information from records to patients if it's not going to hurt the patient's mental health. I do not believe we need to get a court order to do that. But even that disclosure is only about the information. It doesn't permit, as I read it, and I believe as the regulations read it, a disclosure of the physical copies of the records.
But I'm just saying the state of Indiana could come in and object if you wanted to use it in a way that was inappropriate under this act.
I don't believe there would be any notice we would have to give Indiana, but for peer review records, which is the subject of the merits dispute, the law of Indiana that these records are not admissible in court is not at all challenged here. So there would be no opportunity for these records to end up in litigation.
But what is the next step? Suppose you discover, you know, that bad things happen when you look at records. Do you have a further legal remedies that you would pursue? Well,
for the past 30 years, IPAS has generally worked in coordination with the state of Indiana and its various supervisory inspector generals to make sure that problems are fixed. And this is actually, I believe, only the second or third suit IPAS has ever had to bring. But, yes, IPAS, if it found violations of state or federal law based on these records, would be entitled to bring actions either being the lawyer for an injured individual or bringing their own action in some kind of representative capacity.
Well, if you bring your own action, could you bring an action for damages or just for some sort of
Not under PAMI, no. There's no cause of action for damages under PAMI. But if, for example, we were suing, as in the case against the Department of Corrections, under the Americans with Disabilities Act as well, something that has its own waiver of sovereign immunity, we might be able to obtain damages under that. And that just brings me to the point I wanted to make, which is that there is, on the Ex parte Young branch again, we have this sense that from the state that perhaps there should be a balancing. And we think there shouldn't be a balancing, that Verizon kind of set the limits of what you should look for in an Ex parte Young action. But if there were a balancing, we think that there's a very relevant factor raised earlier in the argument, which is that the state decided that IPAS was going to be its protection and advocacy service. It could have designated a municipal entity. It could have designated a private entity. It chose to cast it as an independent state commission. And any sovereignty friction that might occur there is a result of its own choice. We're not suggesting that that's a classic waiver in the MCI sense, in the sense that it's a clear and unmistakable waiver of sovereign immunity. But, of course, we don't need that because, again, we're in Ex parte Young, where they're divested of their immunity because they're state officials seeking of only prospective relief to vindicate federal law.
Mr. Gallagher, do you know if the holding of the holdings of Ex parte Young by a representative of his
Not of the same state, no, Your Honor. I mean, we have cited in our brief school districts, right. Municipalities, right. Sanitary districts, right. Private corporations, all of which are just creatures of the state. We have other states suing state officials. But, no, we don't have that. But that's because this is a very unique statute in that it vests in whoever the state designates federal rights. The state, by designating IPAS, gave it federal rights, which it then can enforce. This most federal statutes don't do this, and this was IPAS's choice to do it. Of course, we point out that this court in City of Chicago versus Lindley, in a similar situation, let the City of Chicago sue the state under 1983. Said it was an appropriate plaintiff under 1983, because in addition to being the City of Chicago, it had also been designated as an area area on aging that allowed it then to enforce federal rights. But the reason that it hasn't come up is because, one, it's a very rare statutory scheme that Congress has adopted here, and two, we do cite a number of other cases involving protection advocacy services, both public and private, which have brought these suits, where states just haven't raised the issue. Partly, we think that's because they acknowledged that they made their bed. They chose who was going to enforce these federal rights.
So 42 states have private agencies, and 8 are structured the way Indiana?
That's correct.
Mr. Galander, now that I understand your waiver argument, I think, but now that the issue is out on the table, do you think it would be better for this court to actually go ahead and address it?
I think either holding that this court, but I think the waiver holding would be just as beneficial for IPAS as a holding on the merits that it can proceed.
Waiver in this particular case?
Well, waiver when you litigate on the merits in district court, you don't raise sovereign immunity in your answer, you don't raise it at any stage until you lose on the merits. That would be a very useful holding both for IPAS and for others. I would also point out that 11th Amendment immunity is such that, for example, in the case below against the Department of Corrections officials brought by IPAS, if IPAS loses on 11th Amendment immunity, there's an immediate interlocutory appeal, and so it can be resolved rather quickly during the case, whereas other issues like the cause of action issue can only be resolved at the end of the case. So the parties may have to expend enormous amounts of energy litigating the facts only to end up finding there's no cause of action. But
I wonder if you could turn to that for a minute. We didn't have a chance to explore that too much with Mr. Fisher, but do you think you need 1983, or is your primary argument that you've got a direct cause of action under the PIMEA Act and the other statute?
The latter, that we have a direct federal cause of action under the PIMEA Act. And
I think you ought to qualify that and say to seek equitable relief.
Absolutely.
Not that. I mean, that's I think the controversy over implied right of actions is about damages suits. You know, they're unlimited. You don't know where you're going to go. Just to seek injunctive relief. If you can't seek injunctive relief, you have nothing, right?
I think that's right. I do want to clarify that IPAS has never sought damages under PAMI. And as far as we know, no court in that has assumed and gone forward on the assumption there's a private right of action has ever awarded damages. And that's not what the protection and advocacy services are about. We want the records. So it's only about prospective relief. We think the 11th Amendment will require that, but that's all the statute we believe would authorize.
So can I follow up on a question Judge Posner asked you a few minutes ago, which is, if you got these records and looked at them, are the kinds of things that would happen, you know, something saying you've got the wrong, you know, staff-to-patient ratio or you've got to be auditing? I mean, what kinds of changes happen when you work with the state agencies?
I mean, that's a good question, and it kind of depends on what's going on. I mean, for the peer review records, for example, what we have here, just as a factual matter, is a woman who came into a state hospital and then responsive, like conscious, awake, and a week later was sent somewhere else unresponsive, and then she died in that other place. And we want to know, first, what happened to her, and the medical records would help us with that. But we also want to make sure that the state hospital did appropriate investigations, that their watchdog system is working properly.
That's the peer review?
Yes, the peer review. That's one of the methods that the hospital uses to make sure that it corrects its own mistakes. And we want to essentially make sure that in their peer review that they have analyzed the matters correctly and that they've taken appropriate remedial measures. Now, in other cases, for example, if we had gotten an incident report of, you know, sexual abuse or something, we would make sure that the hospital was reporting that as a mandatory reporter, and if they weren't, we might do that ourselves. But we work with these other agencies. We don't view ourselves primarily as the person who's, you know, taking up the bad physical treatment or the fraud that goes on, but we're looking to make sure the systems are working and that they're working adequately so that people with mental illness and people with developmental disabilities are protected within the system.
This is not focused on that particular patient. The peer review won't help you with that particular patient.
It will help us with the particular patient to understand what happened with regard to patient one. It will also help us because we look for patterns over time. You know, are there people that are not doing what they should? Are there systems that are not performing adequately? So we look. We get these records and we keep them for 5 years so we can identify trends and then go back to the hospital or the higher ups and say, here's where the problem points are.
In this case, you have some records, but not the ones that.
Yes. I mean, after we filed our response brief at the NBank stage, the state gave us the medical records for patient one. At the time they filed their reply brief at the NBank stage, they gave us additional records, which they said contained the incident report we had sought. In fact, it does not contain the incident report we had sought. They then told us that the incident report probably doesn't exist. We pushed back on that, and they are continuing to investigate whether that incident report has been sought. Now, I have to say that this is better than what happened in the district court, where the Solicitor General was not involved, where they admitted they had to provide the incident report, but simply didn't do it. And even in their Court of Appeals brief, they did not appeal the incident report issue, but still didn't provide it. And they didn't have to because they had obtained a stay of the injunction.
Before, if you should get record that you are seeking, will...
I don't think it will be technically moot for a couple reasons. First, it would be the voluntary action on the part of the defendant. And so there's a presumption against mootness. If there's going to be issues of mootness, we think it's best handled by the district court, who can figure out whether they've complying with the injunction, what's left to be done, whether a declaratory judgment might now be appropriate given the reluctance of the defendants to release the records.
Before you go,
your auditing function or your investigating function, you respond to individual complaints?
We do have complaints as one way that we.
What is your other avenue?
Newspaper articles. In this case, for example, someone from the staff at the hospital called and said, there was a death.
In the case of an inquiry which causes you to seek records, What are the parameters to establish whether there's a pattern? Could you seek a year back, 2 years back? What would be your focus?
Well, two things. First of all, we can only access records if we have either the patient's consent, a complaint, or some kind of probable cause. And we can't seek all records. We only would be able to seek records for the particular patient.
Well, how do you establish the pattern that you mentioned you're concerned about if an institution, in your view, is suspect?
Because we have consents from a lot of patients to monitor have access to their records.
And how are those obtained?
My understanding, generally when they enter the facility, they are asked whether they want IPAS to be able to access their records. But more generally is when we get complaints and we investigate, we then build up this body of records. It's not complete. It's certainly not what the hospital has. But it's the records of the problem patients. And we're able to develop from that trends and patterns and see where further investigation is warranted.
As I see your time is running, and we spent some time with your opposing counsel talking about whether this could have been brought in state court, would the Indiana State Court offer the remedies needed to enforce PAMI and get access to the records, in your view?
Well, I am in a similar position as my friend in that actually, I'm in a worse position than my friend because I don't know what he's going to argue in the state court. But I can tell you that if he's objecting here that there's a problem with Ex parte Young because there's a state agency as the plaintiff, I don't hear why he wouldn't raise the same objection in the state courts in a mandamus action. And I'd have to say mandamus is not the same as an injunction. They're very close. But there's no such thing as a preliminary mandamus. Mm-hmm. If we need immediate relief, we're not going to get it. The mandamus is much more at the discretion of the court, whereas an injunction is more, not entirely, as of right. And there's also something valuable about getting these federal issues resolved in federal court. Here, the only issue on the merits is whether a state law is preempted by the PAMI Act, which is a classic Ex parte Young inquiry, where one party comes in and says, stop complying with state law because I have a federal right to, you know, these records. And that is exactly what we're seeking here. We're not suggesting that we couldn't bring our federal cause of action in state court. We would be surprised, however, if we brought such an action, the defendants probably would remove it to federal court. And just one last point on the prospective relief I just wanted to mention, that in addition to it just being prospective, and this is another reason perhaps to avoid 1983, is that there's no attorney's fees either. I mean, we are paid to do this by the federal government, not very much, and we get no money from Indiana. And we get no money from Indiana, but we are not in the litigation business to generate fees. If we were found to have a right of action under 1983, though, we would probably seek them, whereas there's no right of no mm-hmm. attorney's fees.
You say you're paid by the federal government?
Yes.
How does that come about? Who signs the check that you get?
Once we are designated by the governor, then under federal law, we are paid directly by Health and Human Services.
So you don't. There's no cutting of a state check.
That, my understanding is there's not, and certainly that is the way the federal law is written. And again, once we've been designated, everything flows from the federal statute, and the state can only redesignate us for good cause. They could always opt out of the program. I see my time is up, but just one last point. On the cutoff issue, there's no administrative mechanism here where we can go and complain to HHS we're not getting the records we seek. And if we aren't able to access the records, then we're not meeting our obligations, and our money may be cut off. All that the state has promised to do is designate an agency that can be effective, and they've designated us. Everything else is supposed to flow from federal law, so the funds that are going to be cut off may not be the state's at all. In fact, we would be penniless.
But could I just ask one clarifying question here before time is up? And there's the concern, obviously, that if funds would be cut off as a remedy, if it cuts off your funds, then, as Judge Rovner suggested, this has a sort of self-defeating quality. Are there other federal funds the state is receiving because IPAS exists and can do its work?
Yes, although it's a little complicated.
That's what I was afraid
under,
of.
Not under, and the government may be able to help with this as well. But under the PAMI Act, mm-hmm. no. But under the Developmental Disabilities Act, which was the mm-hmm. statute, they had to, their obligation to receive the funds is to designate this PNA. But all their assurance is to do now is to coordinate with the PNA. That's what they have to do to continue getting their Part B funds. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
Ms. Klein.
May it please the Court, Elisa Klein for the United States. I'll just pick up right where Mr. Galanter left off, and his description is exactly right. You know, we now have about 30 years of experience under this program. The way it works on the ground, and you know, largely this was implemented in the late 70s, is that to be eligible for money, it was originally to be eligible and still for money under Part B, as in boy, of the Developmental Disabilities Act, as well as under Part C, which is the money that goes right to the PNA system. All the state had to do was designate the entity to receive the federal funds. It did not require implementing state legislation. Indiana is fairly typical in that, as was pointed out, there's no state law that gives IPAS a right of access to records or facilities, residents, the other requirements that are in the federal law, 10805, 10806. It was just a designation of IPAS as the agency that would serve as the PNA system for the state. Some states don't even have implementing legislation at all. It was just a designation by the governor. That's my entity. Sometimes it was done by letter to the Department of Health and Human Services. And the implication is not that all of these states are out of compliance with their grant obligations. That's never been the understanding of the Department of Health and Human Services. It would not withhold funds on that basis. Once the designation is made to an eligible system, the authorities are vested in that system by virtue of federal law. So the right of access to records is a federal right. It would preempt contrary state law, and it's always been enforced.
What in the federal statute says that? The statute appears to make these conditions of being funded and not consequences of being funded.
Well,
you read them as consequences.
Your Honor
so.
Raised it as two possibilities in the panel decision. It could be that the state, to get the money, has to enact detailed implementing legislation or regulations, and otherwise it's out of compliance. Or it could be, I'm not saying this is dictated by the language as written on the page, you know, back in the 1970s, or it could be, no, they just have to designate the entity. It has to be an independent entity, but they designate it, and then the powers flow from federal law. And what I'm saying is that the second is the way it's been understood by all the states, because they have
but
not
the,
enacted
the problem
it.
Is that one could say that the very same thing in cases such as Alexander against Sandoval or Gonzaga University. In fact, the federal government did say the very same thing in those cases, and the Supreme Court thought otherwise. What are we to make of,
as we discussed in our brief, those
counsel,
are,
counsel, what are we to make of cases like Bruner against the Ohio Republican Party or Gonzaga University, which don't say taking the money brings the conditions into force?
That's correct. And what you look at is the specific language of the provisions at issue here. Gonzaga had very different statutory language. Obviously, we were in Gonzaga. We told the court, no, this is not an enforceable federal right. Here, the language is quite different. It says the protection and advocacy system shall have access to records under the specified conditions, shall have access to facilities under the specified conditions. It doesn't matter what the configuration of the dispute is. You could have a state-run PNA system or a privately-run PNA system. You could have a state hospital or a private hospital. The federal right is the same. Gonzaga was framed as a direct.
Are you willing to say the same thing about Bruner?
Your Honor, the point is really just about the language of this specific statute,
yeah,
and what
but
Congress
look,
is doing.
Look, we've got three recent decisions of the Supreme Court which say pretty loudly that funding statutes are enforced by cutting off funds rather than reading the conditions as if they were substantive creations that come about by taking the money. The conditions in Bruner looked every bit as certain as the conditions here. So can one say about Bruner what you just said about Gonzaga? That's my question.
I haven't briefed Bruner. I have briefed Gonzaga, and I know that it looks nothing like the scheme here. We don't have any enforcement mechanism in Department of Health.
But we can't just look at Gonzaga. We got three recent decisions of the Supreme Court on this subject, Bruner, Gonzaga, and Alexander against Sandoval. And what we've got, what one would have to say for your position to be right, is that in all three of those, the funding conditions didn't look like things that would take effect just when the state takes the money.
Well, I'm confident that is what I would say if we were walking through the schemes.
Yeah,
Gonzaga.
It's very hard to say that about the statute in Bruner.
Well, again, we have 30 years of how the states have understood this program and how the Department of Health and Human Services have understood this program and how all of the federal courts to address suits have understood this program. And in each case, what has been said is, once the entity exists and it's been designated, the rights flow from federal law. This is also the way Congress has revisited this area a number of times when it first enacted the PAMI Act and when it reauthorized the programs. When Congress enacted the PAMI Act, and it was just expanding on the same systems that existed under the Developmental Disabilities Act, if you look at the conference report, what the conference said is the bill gives systems authority to access records to pursue legal remedies. I'm not aware of any suggestion in any of the cases or the legislative history that in reality it's all been done wrong. What the state should have done was enacted detailed state legislation and then provided separate causes of action. That's not how this works. It's federal rights of access to documents and facilities and go into federal court. It's just prospective relief. There are no damages claims. But that's how these programs get enforced.
So do you conceptualize, then, the role of the P&A agencies as essentially being acting as an agent of the federal government suing these various state entities?
Well, we would conceptualize it. It's acting in the broad sense on behalf of the individuals with mental illness or developmental disabilities, and it's enforcing federal requirements.
But institutionally, if its money flows from the federal government and if the authorities that it possesses flow only from a federal statute and so on, it sounds to me like you're almost making an agency argument of that type.
Well, it's certainly the reasons that it's not like a typical state agency. I mean, as Judge Hamilton pointed out, this is not like the state treasurer suing the attorney general. We have, it's not unique, but extremely unusual situation, but also like in the city of Chicago case where you have there it was a local government, here it's a state agency, but its existence is in order to ensure that federal grants are properly being implemented. And so just as in the City of Chicago case, yes, in that unusual situation, also in Lassen, the Supreme Court case, where the dispute was between the Arizona Highway Department and the Arizona Land Commissioner, yes, that's unusual. However, there it was about how lands that had been granted by the federal government were to be used and what compensation had to be paid if the state highway department was using rights of way on the state trust land. And because this turned on the interpretation of a federal statute, the Supreme Court said this is properly before us, even though it's in form and substance a controversy between two agencies of the state of Arizona. They are both formally represented by the state's attorney general. It's certainly unusual to see a federal court suit where on one side you have either a state agency or a city suing officials of its own state. But it certainly doesn't raise an 11th Amendment issue if what you're seeking is prospective relief against a state official, named in his official capacity. That's Ex parte Young, and as Verizon made clear, to determine if Ex parte Young is applicable, we don't have a multi-factored analysis of is there an adequate state remedy or how important are the sovereign interests. That was what Justice Kennedy was proposing, but it was rejected in Verizon, as this court observed in the Ameritech decision and the Tenth Circuit concluded in the Tarrant case. So it's to the extent there are concerns, they're not 11th Amendment concerns, and we don't need a waiver because once you satisfy Ex parte Young, the 11th Amendment is not implicated. the question is more of, it's sometimes called standing, sometimes it's called merits, but does this part of the state have federal rights enforceable against another part of its own state? And though it's rare, it happens. And this is probably the paradigmatic example in which it happens. And particularly because the state can choose whether to vest these, you know, have these powers be vested in a private or a public P&A system, it really would make no sense to say, by virtue of that choice, it could unilaterally have an entirely different scheme when when there was a dispute, and there are legitimate disputes over the scope of the access to records or access to documents, but those get resolved in federal court. Unless the court has questions, I'll rest in our brief.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. Anything further, Mr. Fisher?
Just a couple of brief points. One, Ms. Klein just referred to this kind of a case as unusual, and I think that's an important word. Going back to the creation of federal courts at the founding, the idea of sovereign immunity was predicated in part on the founders' idea that federal courts were not for anomalous or unusual actions. A state agency suing another state agency in federal court is an anomalous and unusual action, and that's why the whole idea of Coeur d'Alene permitting that kind of questioning, I think, remains. And in fact, if we look at Verizon Maryland, the court not only asked about the kind of relief being sought, but then went on to ask whether there was, as in Seminole Tribe, some sort of sophisticated remedial scheme that would substitute for ex parte Young relief. So it's not as if the end point is, let's ask about the kind of relief and the nature of the defendant, and that's it. There is an opportunity.
Well, what's your view on the Bronner-Gonzaga and Sandoval-Alexander case that Judge Easterbrook asked you about? He didn't cite the Bronner case. He did cite.
Well, we view this slightly differently from the way the United States does. We agree that we are not required as a condition of the grant to enact an elaborate repeat of the provisions in the acts themselves. But that does not mean that we see them as the consequence of the grant, the power bestowed on IPAS. What we see is that as a condition of receiving.
Well, I'm lost. You say you don't have any obligation in order to retain the funds. You have no obligation to create a remedial scheme, a scheme of legally enforcement. You don't have to enact anything. Everything is complete.
We have to designate them.
Just what Ms. Klein was saying, you just have to designate. You don't have to enact implementing legislation.
Right. Our view is that implicitly flowing from that is that they can then come in and do what the Act contemplates that they will do, as long as we don't interfere with that. If we interfere with that, then that would put us in contravention of the conditions of the grant.
Yeah, of course, you're arguing that because, of course, if you were required to establish some remedial scheme, you didn't, you might be. But that's fine.
Mm-hmm. As to the point.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Okay, thank you.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will take a brief recess before the second case.